Welcome back to the Jasmine Star Show. This is the first time ever I've had three amazing guests all at one time. Now, to bring you guys back up, if we haven't been watching or listening to the preceding episodes, I have had the pleasure of interviewing each person individually. And now, for our own version, am I going to say The View or is it? No, it's not The View. This is The Unview. This is The Unfocused, not The View. Ladies, welcome back. If you can go around the table, I'm going to start here with Chelsea. Sure. Do a brief welcome back introduction of who you are, what you do, and then we're going to talk about the perspectives and get into business.
Sure. So I'm Chelsea Grayson. I'm the former CEO and board member of American Apparel, True Religion, and most recently Spark Networks. And I also sit on a ton of public and private company boards.
Hi, I am Susan Sirota. I really love to help builders tackle the huge challenges of building businesses. And I do that through being a director, advisor, sometimes coach. And yeah, I've built a couple myself.
And sponsor.
Yes. Hi, everyone. I'm Jocelyn Moore. I'm an executive strategist. I also sit on a couple of public company boards as well as a private board.
Okay. So in our last conversations, we have seen them in their utmost professional, but you get this crew of amazing, brilliant women and they're just going 1,000 miles a minute. So I was like, can we have a roundtable conversation about business? Because if I was sitting at a table next to you, I would unabashedly be eavesdropping because you guys think so differently. It's like, how can I connect you? What are you doing? How do we support each other? So can we start the conversation from that place? Start the place of how did you guys start creating these connections? What are you thinking of as you're creating these connections? And then as a listener is thinking, how do I duplicate this in my neck of the woods with my group of friends?
It was magic when we came together.
Total magic.
It was like, it was a spark, you know, it really was, which is why we've had such longevity in this relationship. We met, can I say it, on Clubhouse?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, we met on Clubhouse in the early days, you know, which was a lot of people's lifesaver during COVID, at least it was for me for sure, you know. And I think we were all up on some stage at some point, you know, and it just slowly, everybody else on stage kind of receded into the background and it was just the three of us and people were raising their hands, asking us questions. And then I think, Susan, it was your idea. Right? You got us on a...
Yeah, it wasn't serendipity. It was not serendipity. Oh, yes.
Susan is a behind-the-scenes stalker and it supports her sponsorship.
I don't have situational awareness. Yes. So I wasn't even aware I had a stalker.
She's so stealthy. She's very stealthy.
Yes, that's a blind spot for me.
Yes, we came together and created magic on Clubhouse. And what had happened is I was doing a room with someone else who was amazing and awesome. And was getting a lot of feedback from people that it was super helpful, but they needed help on more issues because our room was focused on SaaS alone. And I had happened to listen to Chelsea and thought she was just amazing. And there aren't many people that I excitingly sit on a panel with because you're endorsing what they're saying.
Well, time out. From a storyteller's perspective, did you know Chelsea before you heard her?
Oh, no. I did not know
her. Okay, so you're just hearing her and you're like magical.
I am like, she knows what she's talking about.
Okay.
And what I loved about Chelsea is I would endorse what she's saying. I could disagree, but that doesn't mean her thinking was great. And she was grounded in reality. She was grounded in her own stories and she led with heart as well. And she cared about the people. And I consciously started listening to her and said, is this going to stick? And it stuck. And then I said, okay, well, we have this powerhouse public company CEO, board director. At the time, I was spending a lot of time in the startup world. And I was like, here's some things we need to round us out. We need someone who has done broader things as well. We need someone who has touched different industries. We need someone who can keep up with us. And so I went to my network and I started seeking. I gave a list of here's all the criteria. I would like to find someone and got introduced to Jocelyn. Mm. It was magic. Mm. And I said, ladies, guess what we're doing?
Mm.
And so you thought it was serendipity.
So wait, how did you get connected? Like, Susan, did you?
We were on stage at some point together, I think, because you did it very naturally and organically. Because
absolutely.
Even know that
I just learned the story about the stealthy stalking last night. So, yes.
But then we were all up there and we had really good chemistry and it happened so organically.
Your start of the story did happen. But it just wasn't like my start.
6 months later.
Oh, my goodness. So funny. Wait, Susan, can you talk about how you endorsed Chelsea and what she would say? There's a certain term that we use.
Oh, yeah. So we were reminiscing last night about our favorite term, which is we get onto things and there's so much greatness in this room and we sheep-eat one another.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was coined by Chelsea.
It was
brilliant because, you know, you get in a room with a lot of men and they happen to mansplain often. And instead of like really elevating what you've said, they tend to be listened to and take the credit for what you said.
Yeah.
We do it differently around here. We sheep eat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Susan has her own personal twist on it. It's the woo-woo.
Yeah.
The
woo-woo. Yeah.
Okay. And so the premise and the framework of that show on Clubhouse was people asking business questions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And yes. So one of the things that we talked about was creating those networks and supporting each other. And, you know, off camera, as we're resetting up this mm-hmm. table, what I hear you guys just say is, oh, that's beautiful. Yes. Okay. Let me know. We'll follow up. I'm going to make an introduction. I'm going to do this. So when you talk about this and this level of closeness and accessibility, talk about the people who went before you. Like what was modeled for you to say, okay, I want that and I'm going to do this. And so I'm going to start, Jocelyn, I'm going to start here because I know we're going to get into the business questions, but I actually just want to lay the framework and like figure out like, how do we pay it forward? How do we continue doing this?
So how is it modeled for me and what I do now? So I have always had very strong women sponsors and men mm-hmm. sponsors. And so I'll just give a couple of stories. When I worked in the Senate, there was a woman, her name is Ellen Dineski. She was my boss in Senator Rockefeller's office where I served the longest. Ellen would put me in any room, seat me at any table, make sure that everyone knew that I was fully supported by the senator. And so that allowed me to kind of see what real sponsorship looked like and do what I needed to do in my job. Jay Rockefeller himself, the senator, and this is a story I'll tell, and this is modeling behavior of sponsorship, Susan. We were negotiating healthcare reform. We were in the speaker's office, the majority leader, office. We're all sitting around a table. The senators were around a table. Staff's in the back. Rockefeller calls me up, and he asked me a question. I answered the question. I'm going to go stand with the staff. Well, Senator Rockefeller takes it one step further. He pulls up a chair, table with all the senators, like Kennedy, names you'll know, all seated around the table. It's a circular table in the U.S. Capitol. Only senators. And he's like, pats it for me to sit down. And wow. I was like, oh no, Senator, I'm going to go sit back here with the staff. He's like, no, you're not. You're going to sit right here at the table where you should be so that I can talk to you. And if I have any questions, I'll just ask you.
I just got goosebumps.
And so I sat right down at that table. No senator batted an eye. But when we think about sponsorship, that is modeling the behavior. When you are really for someone, you show up for them, you make it clear to other people, this is your person and this person is completely qualified to do all the things. And so I've had a lot of great models. Those are just a couple of examples and more importantly, great sponsors.
I love that. Susan?
My story starts opposite. I didn't have any sponsors.
No, hold on. I want to be careful of the vernacular. So sponsors, how are you defining a sponsor? Because we've adopted that and be like, oh yeah, you're not a mentor. You're a sponsor.
The problem with the word mentorship to us, because we've talked about this, is that women tend to get over-mentored. Women tend to get mentored. Men tend to get money. Mm-hmm. And so men connect one another naturally. It's just been the way of it. Networks help networks. And so when we talk about sponsoring, it means that that person's name is going to come out of your mouth when they're not in the room. You put them in the room when they're not there because you believe in everything that they can do and they are the right person for it. And so I proactively look for opportunities to put all three of you in the room. And I know you do the exact same thing.
Absolutely.
And that's sponsorship.
Mm. Okay. So you didn't have sponsorship.
I didn't. I left my family home very early as a straight kid, high school dropout. I actually have a master's now, but I went through that path. And it was very lonely. And I was very fortunate to get myself into Procter & Gamble where sponsorship was a thing. And it was such a big deal for me to see it. And it was, up until that time, I was so lonely. And then when I started getting it, I felt like I didn't deserve it. And that was the moment when I figured out that actually I do deserve this and I have a right to be in this room, that I made a promise to myself that I am going to spend my life finding magical people and sponsoring them because I never want someone to feel that alone and lonely if they do the work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
Wow, Susan. I gave me chills.
Yeah. I feel like we're doing that skit from SNL. Oh, yeah. But you can't help it. You can't help it. You just took it to church run. Yes, that's right. That's right. Chelsea, tell us about somebody who sponsored you.
Yeah, I love that we're having this conversation because it's actually a whole thing right now. I feel like Gen Z, Gen A even, they are not experiencing, whether it's mentorship and or sponsorship
so
at all, and for sure not the way that we all experienced it in our generation. That's just, it's a lost art. Yeah. And I don't know if it's because, you know, I think COVID accelerated, you know, the, you know, kind of loss of the mentor and the sponsorship, you know, model, or maybe it's because these generations weren't receiving it in the same way we were, because we all felt just so grateful to be meeting people that might be willing to train and develop us. You know, I don't know about you're scrappy. I mean, I'm like, we all had to sort of make our own way in the world, you know, and we were just so grateful to be there that we accepted all of that, you know, help. And I think that people aren't willing to give help that they don't feel like is being received without some air of entitlement, you know? So anyway, so I'll just say it's a lost art for sure. And, you know, I really hope that it starts to come back again, especially with Gen A, because selfishly my kids are in Gen A, you know. But I do think, I do agree, there's a difference between mentorship and sponsorship. You know, I think mentorship is about training and development. And here's what you say when you go to this cocktail function. Here's how you have to act on the golf course. Here's how you would go and present this particular memo to this partner. Or, you know, here's, and then sponsorship, you're absolutely right, is about opening the doors, you know, spreading reputation, you know, around in other rooms where that person isn't, you know. And I think that, to your point, Jocelyn, you take sponsors and mentors that look like you and kind of are you, that you'd model yourself after, a woman, for example, but you also have to take them from out of left field, completely, totally not you. That's right. Because those, like I said earlier, the pale males and stales or whatever, those are the guys, you know, or whoever, that are going to open doors for you that you didn't even know existed.
Completely.
Absolutely.
It's the people that look like us that open the doors where we're like, I want to go through that door. Can you help me get a key to it? It's the people that don't look like us at all that'll get you in places you didn't even know were there, and but you should be in there, you know?
Right?
Yeah.
Like, here's a door you didn't know existed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and so, and I've had them all different kind of ways over the years. And then the cool part about it is, you know, once you get to, I'm 52, I think you're like in my marathon bracket, right? You're a little young, maybe.
I'm not saying anything about me.
But once you get to this point, you know, you still have those people in your life, but they become colleagues, you know, and you can still learn from them because they're still a little bit ahead of you, but now you're sitting shoulder to shoulder. They might even be asking you questions along the way because they want that new state-of-the-art perspective. So then it just develops into your wonderful personal board of directors that you can go back to as a trusted advisory group when you are at a loss with your own people, you know?
And I also think this ties back to how we all came together and why it was magical, because we're sitting here talking about sponsoring folks and the importance of it. And all three of us genuinely wanted to continue to find new ways to give back, especially in the hardest times of the pandemic. And that's why we were doing it. There was not anything in it for us. And outside of that joy of being able to find new avenues to find the people that we want to lift up.
Which and I want to interject a little bit of hope for the Zers and the Xers and all the
Aers.
And the Aers who are out there. I do think COVID was a great democratization. I think when we at Clubhouse, we look at, and I know I keep shouting out LinkedIn. I'm not a paid advertiser for that.
We'll be after
Maybe
that.
I should be.
LinkedIn, put her on your board. You'd be lucky to have her.
But the point being, you can, I feel like the Gen Zers, the Aers, everybody, you have that access in a different way. And so maybe it's more one-on-one. But to your point, Chelsea, the, you know, big groups of, you know, whether it's the baby boomers or others really taking on that mentorship mantle. I just think that the way that work has transformed, and I can say a whole lot more about that, but I'm just going to interject. I think the hope and why we came together and the workforce, as it changes, more women are becoming entrepreneurs, more folks are out in the world and don't necessarily have an infrastructure. So I'm hopeful that the democratization that happened in COVID will continue and a lot more of that one-on-one sponsorship mentoring is happening and that people are really connecting around the money, around building generational wealth and around just whatever they want to, you know, have happen in their
lives. I love this. I'm going to pop in. So just before we started recording, I went on Instagram to source questions from people who wouldn't otherwise the opportunity to ask these questions.
Yes.
But, here's a question that was like right in alignment. Now, I'm going to serve it up, and it's Be Lovely, Be You. She asked, how do you choose a mentor and assess the ROI when it seems intangible but of high value?
Yeah, you can make a mistake. You can but just fail fast and realize this isn't the right person for you, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, it's okay to
But I'm
going to
break this down because somebody's listening and she's like, assess, it's not right. But how? When? Yeah. Why? What's too long? What's too soon?
I mean, the first one is always the most interesting one, right? And then I feel like it opens the gate to, you know, the floodgates to the rest of them. But, you know, you have to have some sense of purpose, right? You've got to set out for yourself a strat plan, whether it's a year out, 3 years out, 5 years out, whatever. So you have to have some shape around where you want your career to go. And you pick somebody who's 20 years ahead of you. And I think, like we were talking about this earlier, in addition to what we talked about during our chat about, you know, say yes to everything, also ask everything, ask for everything. You were talking about how you got your first house a while ago, you know, and you wrote a letter to the seller and, you know, oh my gosh, you know, like the gumption to be able to do something like that and then get that house. You can reach out to somebody on LinkedIn. Now I'll be a paid advisor too on LinkedIn.
We should all be paid advisors.
You can DM somebody. I've gotten some crazy DMs from people where I was like, you're a MBA student? Wait, what? You're
exactly.
But then you can forge a connection, you know, and that, how else are they going to reach out and get me unless you're at an organization together, in which case make a meeting, make a 15-minute meeting. It could even be over Zoom. And say, look, I admire where you are. You're 20 years ahead of where I am, but in 20 years, you're who I want to be. Here's the reasons. Would you take me under your wing? Would you walk me into those rooms so I can see what the dynamic is like? You know, would you talk to me about, you know, the five steps to, you know, how X, Y, and Z gets done? And the worst that can happen is you get a no, you know, but you'll probably still get a LinkedIn connection out of it. And then who knows where that goes.
I want to build on that because I think that can work half the time. Mm. I think the other half, you don't want to ask anyone to be your mentor. Mm. And so it really is reading it. What I think you do is you do exactly, what Chelsea just said, is you do your research, you know what you want, and you find someone who's been there, done that, and you reach out and you get ask them for something very specific to help you with that. Yeah. And then what you do there, it's easier for that person who isn't committed to you yet to do one thing that makes them feel good because it's leveraging their experience. They give you that piece of advice. Then what you do next is you follow back up and you let them know how you applied their advice and what happened, good or bad. It's how our relationship started and why I was so wildly attracted to you, Jasmine, because you followed up and you said, this is what I did. Thank you for taking your time. This mattered. And then that person now has some buy-in into what you're doing. They have some ownership into your results and you can start letting that relationship develop more naturally. You're not asking for that huge commitment up front.
By the way, these people are in your daily life all over
the place.
This
is what I was going to say.
They sit in the office next to you. They're an advisor on something you're working on. Yeah, they're
good.
All over the place. Just look for them and make the ask.
And I would say to be lovely, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. How are you leveraging your current networks? If you look up and you look around, your mentors are often already there. They're already in place and they've already been mentoring you. You may not identify them as such. And I take a more amorphous approach to things. I don't necessarily do all the planning. I'm a little bit more serendipitous. and so my mentors were always there. We've talked about it. They were always there all the time, like guiding me gently, advising me gently. And so calling them, sometimes I may not have ever said you were a mentor, but when I look back, hindsight, oh my goodness, this person opened all these doors and maybe they were a mentor and sponsor. So I would say to our listener, you know, this person is probably already within your network and that makes the connection and the bond that much more easy because they are already invested in your success. And it could be a friend, it could be a colleague, it could be a family member. Like there are lots of ways to leverage people in our lives to help with our journey.
Okay. As a point of clarity.
Can I say that we all come at things differently and it's awesome.
And I love it. Yes. And it should be.
That's what I missed.
But Be Lovely Be You had said to assess the ROI. Yeah. So you guys, let's bring this back down.
So let me get there.
There are people who are like, I want to pay for a mentor. Do you guys agree with me?
No.
And I'm adamantly opposed.
God, no. Absolutely.
I'm vehemently opposed.
Absolutely.
This goes back to what Susan was saying.
That's a coach.
Yeah, but also what Susan.
Not a mentor. Yeah. You can pay for a coach. Okay, that's fine. But also, that's a whole other ball of wax we won't get into. It's okay. But that is, no, a mentor is doing this because it's generational fall forward. They want to have someone to pay into their social security or whatever, right? Like, we're doing this to bring up the next generation. Yeah, it's like a pay forward, you know? I mean, we're not doing this for money. We're doing this to help, you know, the next folks coming up. But the ROI thing is also, I love that she's asking that, but this is not a thing where you can measure ROI necessarily by, okay, well, this one thing worked, and so now I'm going to go back to that same person. I'm going to keep going back to this well until it doesn't generate anything. It could be 20 years until that thing develops into something. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't take you much more than 15 minutes a month, you know, to stay in touch with somebody and stay in their orbit. You never know what room that person's going to be in. You never know, right? You never know when you guys might be around the same age at some point, and now you're sitting shoulder to shoulder and you've just developed a professional relationship along the way. We don't need to cast people aside because next month I didn't make more money or get that promotion from talking to you.
Yeah. The ROI part, the mentorship. So no, don't pay for mentorship. This goes to Susan's point about, you know, women, people of color, frequently over-mentored, and it is not necessary in all cases. People should be educated and put in the work, but it's not the over-mentoring and over-education, not necessary. But when you think about ROI, it goes back to something you and I talked about previously. The ROI is the relationship itself. Full stop, right? The fact that you have this relationship, you don't know when that relationship is going to pay dividends. You don't know what those dividends are going to be like. You know, you don't know what moment in your life you're going to be in, which is why mentors and sponsors show up in all kinds of ways, shapes and sizes, right? Mm-hmm. It may be a personal issue. It could be a professional issue, but your ROI is the relationship itself. And I'm going to just keep underlining that, molding all of it, because that is the return on investment. The fact that you
so have true. Mm-hmm. Play long-term games with long-term people.
Yeah. So what do you guys say to the person who, okay, I'm just going to call it for what it is.
Okay.
Please.
You guys are very strong and promising. And in a room full of people, you would stand out for nothing other than your sheer will to succeed. Mm-hmm. Now, there's somebody who's listening who says, nobody's ever brought up Senator Rockefeller. Never has pulled up a chair for me. We're not even saying that case. There's their version of the senator. Yeah. And nobody's ever opened a door or held an elevator, and they can't get a break. And so is this a you thing? You got to do something to be remarkable enough to sit at the table? Or like, where?
Everyone's remarkable enough to sit at the table. Yeah. It's just what table you sit at.
And everyone's remarkable in your own network. That person might not be Rockefeller in your network, but you don't know what that person's going to be in 10 years. That person could just be remarkable in the organization you're in right now. Maybe they've never been on the front page of the paper or testified in front of Congress, but they can, you know, they can help you within your organization. And now you join, we were talking earlier about joining trade organizations or attending, you know, panels or, you know, conferences or events, you're going to meet people there. And slowly but surely, everybody can get, everyone's 6 degrees away from Rockefeller, trust me, or a Rockefeller-like, or whoever it was you were talking about. I can't remember, but I mean, everybody is 6 degrees away from whoever it is that you really aspire to meet. But don't discount anybody in your network. They're all important.
And we weren't always fully formed, and I'm not suggesting I'm fully formed now, but, you know, when we think about the moments of clay and when we were being molded and, you know, early days, it was people like my friends who I went to college with or friends from high school. It was, you know, those are folks still in my network. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it might be a connection point for something that I need for my family in Atlanta. It might be, you know, hey, you're the concert promoter for so-and-so and I want to go to this concert. Like, it doesn't have to be a Rockefeller level. Every relationship is valuable. And we have to think about not just those big moments, maybe when we're fully formed or still in the process of being formed, but it's those small moments at the beginning and throughout life that really matter. Those relationships matter. And again, going to go back, the relationship itself, ROI enough. Mm-hmm. Mm.
But don't, your people who are going to naturally mentor you also don't want to feel like it's transactional. That's why right. I hate it. That's why I want to steer your person away from using that ROI concept, you know, or from even the idea of, well, there's nobody as important in my network as Rockefeller. So what are we really doing here? I want to pay somebody to... It's that nobody wants to feel like they're in a transactional relationship. They want to feel good about what they're doing for you, and you want to feel good for having received it. So I think you just kind of flip that concept a little bit.
Can I just say the most important people in my network are the cheerleaders, my friends, like you,
for sure.
Right? Yes, we're all at business, but I have folks who, and this is my kitchen cabinet partly, but it's like my lifelong friends who, you know, there's nothing other than being my friend. That relationship delivers, and I know we don't want to use the term ROI, but it delivers every day because they tell me, Jocelyn, like, you should be thinking about this, or, you know, you're overreacting here, or, you know, why don't you go take a vacation? Like, those are the things that really matter. And when we have those people in our lives, they are mentoring us along the way. They're giving us what we need in a different way.
Yeah. What's that phrase that you are the sum of the top five people you hang out with?
That's exactly right.
Surround yourself by. And
yes.
Look at those. Look at that list.
Yeah. And I just, adding to that, we were talking before we started taping about one of the things that we found interesting is that all four of us here didn't start with the leg up. No. None of us came from, here is our family money, here Ivy League schools, any of that. Yeah. We all figured out at the beginning, I think the common thing was do good and it comes back. Like, it's what you're saying about not being transactional. It's about what you're saying about the relationship itself. It's like, put yourself in rooms and be a good person. Other people, and then ask for help back. Have the courage to do it. And that's what it really takes to get started.
I think it's like a perfect segue. I have another question, if you guys would allow.
Oh, of course.
The Annie Method, she asked, how do you manage close relationships seeking more from you as your success grew?
That's a great question.
That's an excellent question.
Jocelyn, you left. You go first.
You know, the people who are meant to be in your orbit, so you can talk about the folks that you mentor or sponsor, and I have a lot. You know, I think people want to see you succeed, so they understand the ebbs and flows, right? They understand that at certain moments, as long as I'm authentic and I show up authentically for people, sometimes that doesn't mean I'm consistent. It doesn't mean you're going to reach me at all times of day and night. But I am, you know that I'm there for you when you need me. And so I think the folks who, the way that those relationships work best is that you understand I'm human too. Like, again, not fully formed, not perfect. I make mistakes and fail every single day, but that's part of the journey, right? When I think of the folks who are my mentors and sponsors, they fail. Sometimes I can't reach them. You know, they have human experiences like the rest of us. And that is what attracts me to them more, because I was like, you know what I've gone through.
That's how you listen to them, because you're in a bad, bad spot. And they're like, let me tell you what happened when I was in this awful spot.
Exactly.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, but what I think I feel like, though, because what I felt like she was asking, and maybe I'm not interpreting right, but it's, how do you manage close relationships seeking more from you as your success grew?
Yeah, okay. But as my success grows, the expectation is that it's more time and more people, right? And so what I'm saying is, for the more time, more people, like the expectation, so I'll give an example. I have a mentee and we used to meet on a pretty regular clip, right? Okay. And so as my, you know, time gets less and less, I don't know if this is a success thing, I can't even talk. As my time gets less and less, I have had to manage that mentorship and mentoring relationship to say, I'm still here for you. And that was my point. Like, it changes too. The relationship changes too.
Got
the
it.
Folks who are with
Got
you,
it.
They don't mind that. They're like, they're clapping for your success.
Got it.
Right? And they understand, because that's something they may want to do, and they see you as a person. They don't see you as a, you know, this is a person over here, and, you know, not really a person, but this, you know, ideal.
I say no a lot.
I say no a lot too. And I also convert some relationships that shouldn't be mentor-mentee or sponsorship relationships, that actually should be advisory relationships, consulting relationships.
Paid.
I'll convert to, we can still have these conversations, but I'm giving you, this isn't just, I'm fostering along your career. I'm helping your business.
Can you please define the two? Can you please define the two, and then educate people about the difference?
It's like the Supreme Court said about porn. You know it when you see it.
Oh gosh. You're one liner.
They really did say that.
You know, they did say that. Yeah.
I use that line now for product marketing.
When it starts to feel transactional, where they're coming back to the well and you're like, am I running your marketing department? Yeah. Am I teaching you how to run your HR? You know when it's less about, I'm helping you, you know, leapfrog to the next part of your career too. I'm just telling you how to run your division now, you know, or I'm just helping. And so you can feel when that starts to happen, and I'll let them get, you know, one or two, you know, go comebacks to the well or whatever, you know. But then I'm just sort of like, gosh, you know what? This actually is how I help people in my consulting. I have an advisory business, a consulting business. This is actually how I help people on the other side of the house. And I really do feel like you'd benefit if a lot more, if we had a much more formal relationship, you know. And so why don't we convert this? Here's my monthly retainer. I don't do hourly, you know, and here's my monthly retainer, and you know, let me know. And then when you make people put their money where their mouth is, they straighten up and fly right pretty easily, right? They either do convert to consulting and now you're just on a nice retainer and, hey, you generated some business for yourself, or they get back to just the pure career stuff, which I'm happy to talk about all the live long day, you know?
I'm with you. And I think that it's how you say no, right? Because what you were saying was when you are now taking advantage and you are making the relationship as a mentee more transactional, I'm okay saying, okay, you want to be transactional. If I'm making you money, then don't take advantage and pay me for it. I also think if it's not the relationship that you have that's asking for more, but you're just getting too many requests from people to serve them, saying no, not me is really helpful. Mm-hmm. It's like being able to say, you know what, I don't have the bandwidth for this right now, but let me connect you with someone who I think could really help. So you're giving, but you're not committing.
Yeah.
And they get what they need. And there's something really wonderful and powerful about the no, not me.
Yeah.
Can I just add, you're seeing some magic here with these two. So I lead with heart, and you see part of my challenge is I may never convert some of my folks. Because I'm like, I can't possibly.
But wait, hold on. Do we understand what's happening here? They're mentoring you.
I know. They do it all the time. Oh my goodness. I love it. They're so good. But I'm always the, I will help you and I'll be, this is why this is such a great question. And you're seeing
mentoring.
Let me tell you, I have a lot more time. My bandwidth might be totally taken up for these mentoring conversations, but I have all the time in the world if you want to pay me.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's how you should think about it. Your schedule will free up dramatically if it's a $20,000 a month retainer on something.
I love it.
I do want to bring it home on the fact that I think that there is a difference between how we react when that question sort of sets us up for taking too much as you get better in your career. And that I think that what you've seen is how we all react when it starts to become transactional to repeat and repeat what Jocelyn was saying, is if someone else, a mentee, makes something more transactional and is wanting more, I back off really quickly. Because that's not the relationship I'm signing up for.
Mm-hmm. Okay, switching gears. I.Acri said, when is the right time for me to launch my product?
I love that question.
Oh, well, we got a lot of answers to that.
Who's going first?
First
hold on,
all,
you guys. Do you guys just understand what just happened? It's like, hold my beer.
Is there a need for your product? And you don't have to be unique. There could be 8 million other products just like this one. But is there still available TAM, right? Yeah. So is there
total addressable market.
Yeah, total. Thank you. Total addressable market. Thank you. You'll put it up on the screen. But are there still people available out there and a large enough one that it makes sense from a monetary perspective that actually want this product? Again, yours doesn't have to be the best, doesn't have to be perfect, doesn't have to be the filling in a niche that's never been filled before. None of that. That's all very daunting. So that, two, do you have a way to make this product that is scalable and doesn't keep you in debt for the next 5 years? Because I don't like this whole, we're not profitable for 5-10 years. Are you going to start making money off this thing pretty quick? And is it scalable? So you're not doing it in your garage forever. Do you see a supply chain out there or a way to make this thing, right? Three, do you understand? And then I'll shut up, okay?
But this is excellent.
And then, you know, three, and there's obviously 8 million other things, but three, do you or do you have somebody who understands, putting aside brand marketing, because as the founder, I would assume you know how to do brand marketing for days because it's your own thing and it's your baby. Do you have somebody who understands marketing technologies? Period, end of story. Because if you are not state-of-the-art on whatever today's best marketing technologies are, you're sunk. I don't care how amazing your shit is. Okay, go.
Okay, so yeah. I go the opposite route. Okay. I love that.
Okay.
I'm like, Jaws was ready to go, and I just jumped
no,
in.
No, go.
I think it's a big ol' it depends on your business. So if you are launching a product that is a physical product, that it's going to take you, you're going to have inventory, it's going to take you 6 months to change something on it when you find out what people love and hate. Get a little more in market. Get some real learnings first before you go. If you are doing a services business or if you are doing some tech businesses, then find a way to launch yesterday. And that might not be a full launch. It might be I'm putting up a page that asks you to enter your credit card to buy this, and then I give you a message when that I don't have a product that put you on the wait list. Like, find ways before you are going all in financially to really support what Chelsea was saying and find out if what you have is right. How do you talk about what you have? And the only real way you do that is by getting yourself out there. And so do it smart. Do it carefully. Make sure that you're not promising something that you can't deliver on. Or if you do promise something that they know its future and you create a magical, wonderful cult from the shared problem. And they'll give you that grace when you're figuring it out. But go in those situations. So it really does depend.
I'm going to sheephead everything that you guys said. And I think you have to really, as you've said, do the work and make sure you know. Like, you can't just say, everybody wants to be a founder. It's a sexy thing. everyone wants to have a product. So you have to really know, is this product viable? What market am I talking about? What are the macroeconomics that I'm starting this business in?
Yeah.
And is it going to work from that standpoint? So I think everything that you guys have said is absolutely true. Now, the other side of that is, I do want people, as they're thinking about founding a business, we don't want to say don't do it. And, you know, failure teaches us, you know, lifelong lessons, but know what you're getting into from the beginning, because you don't want to, as we talk about, you know, generational wealth, there's a fast way to not have generational wealth is if you fail horribly and have spent all of your money because you didn't do the research. Absolutely. So I think there are lots of layers there.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to repeat because I take notes and this is how I learn. If you have a question, when is it ready to launch my offer? Chelsea, focus on the total addressable market. Figure out the path to profitability. This is not going to be, I'm going to be in debt for 5-10 right. years.
There's no glory.
There's no glory in that. And then understand the latest marketing technologies. If not you, then somebody on your team. Yeah. Susan says, it depends. If you are doing a product, it's okay to go a little slower. If you're doing a service, move as fast as possible. But the goal is always, can you deliver on the promise? And Jocelyn had said, number one, do the work. Mm-hmm. You have to understand what you're getting into, understand if it's viable and the macro considerations. And then she had said, lastly, know what you're getting into. And that's where I have a question. I never knew what I was getting into. Like, come on, you guys. Like, did you guys ever know what you were? No. I mean, this isn't like a big thing. Like, how do you know? Like, what now? Somebody's listening and be like, what do I need to know?
I'm going to challenge you.
Okay.
So
I think you knew what you were getting into. There's an evil empire in you. Like, there wasn't like Jeff Bezos. It wasn't like, I'm going to sell the most books on the internet ever. No, he was like, world domination. I'm going to sell everything everywhere all the time. Only Alibaba is going to challenge me, and not even them sometimes, right? I mean, like, I think every successful entrepreneur like you, you know, there's something where you might not be able to predict the future, but you know what your empire is going to be. You're thinking world domination always, right? Huh. I mean, I think so. I don't think you're ever thinking small.
Okay, but I hear it as a difference. Okay. And I mean, let me hear the nuances. It's know what you're getting into, and then know what it is you want, or knowing the vision.
Well, so, okay, getting into, I think, would, and then I'll shut up. Sorry.
No.
But like, I think there's no,
Chelsea,
if you knew what you were getting into, you'd never do anything, you know, because the hard work, the sleepless nights, the missing the meals, the missing everything and all the time and all at once, right? Like, so I don't, like, knowing what you're getting into, don't even put that in the back of your brain and don't think about it again, because that'll be paralysis.
So here's what I'm going to say about when you started thinking about getting into the various markets, photography, content, SaaS. You did have to know something about the market. You didn't just say, well, and maybe you did, but I believe that you did know. And if you're offering a product, you have to know something about the market. The distinction, I think, in terms of, you know, you're just going to jump out there and you don't have to know everything. I think that's a different level. I think it's on a different plane. And I don't know exactly how to articulate it. So I'll just give an example. For me, I said, my career has been serendipitous. I've never planned this is what I'm going to do ever, right? But in politics, I knew a little bit about politics. Like I knew the basics of politics. I had done the work. Did I know how my career was going to go? Did I plan any of that out? Absolutely not. And I went, like, I just jumped right into it. I think the difference is you have to know a little bit about the market that you're getting into. And that's what I mean.
Got it.
But that does not order your steps. You can just like, I jump off a cliff, like in the political realm, having no parachute. But I knew I would land.
Got it. And okay, there is a difference too, a slight difference of knowing what you're getting into in a smart, know your market, know your customer, the things you're saying.
Yes.
And knowing what I'm getting into as the emotional journey, I'm about ready to go through hell. And there it is, you're ahead of your skis, you're building a business. Yeah. Right. You can't define that. You can't listen to that. You can't, I'm told, go through horrible childbirth and then have another baby because they don't remember that pain, but the pain is real, right? The pain in building is real. And I think that you can't really know until you know how bad and how hard and how lonely it's going to be at moments. But you also don't know how great, how much you're going to learn, how much you're going to grow, the people you're going to meet along the way, and the human you become because of it. You don't know that, but you will experience both.
So before I went to law school, I read a book called 1L. By Scott Turow.
Oh, yeah.
I know. And I mean, this is like, this is the book that you that read before you go to law school. And he literally on page one is saying, don't go to law school.
Yeah.
Like if you're going for all of these reasons,
don't go.
Yeah. Don't go. Yeah. And then he gets into explicit details telling you the horror stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so.
And they're all true.
And they're all true. Yeah. All of them. He is not wrong.
We experienced them all.
The reason why that book is still in print and still doing extraordinarily well is because it spits the truth.
Yeah.
So if somebody had told you all the painstaking experiences, would you have even listened?
No, I mean, you know what your billable hours are, your minimum is when you go to a big law firm like I started out with, you know.
But in business, if you wrote the 1L for business owners, do you think that anybody would even adhere to your advice?
What do you mean? So like if I,
don't start a business if
you're an entrepreneur, if you're a small business founder, you have something in you that is a burning compulsion to make that product, to develop that service, to provide whatever it is, to build this business around this. If you don't, you shouldn't be doing it at all. Like Scott Turow said about law school. Okay. If you don't have that, you shouldn't be doing that.
Can you say that again a little bit slower? If you don't have what? Like
if you're not compelled to do this thing, notwithstanding what everyone's telling you about, you know, the hours, the things you're going to miss, the meals you're going to miss, the relationships that you might burn a bridge in or whatever, you know, the debt, whatever it is, the sleepless nights, the stress, the anxiety. Difference between the two, of course, is stressing about something that exists already. Anxiety is worrying about something that has not yet come to pass, you know, and you have both when you're an entrepreneur. If any of that deters you, and you don't have a compulsion to move forward with your thing, then you shouldn't be doing that thing.
Ooh.
I'm going to take a different view because I do think some of life has to just be the journey, whether or not you have a compulsion or not, right? There are things that I would tell you I've done, but I haven't been completely, like, I'm like, oh, the NFL was an example, right? When I said I didn't want to go, had work-life balance, but it turned out to be amazing. I didn't have a compulsion around it. I know that's slightly different, but that was my career at that point in time.
Yeah.
And I think when you talked about American Apparel, right? That wasn't completely like, I am so committed to doing this and this was my path. This is what I wanted to do. So I think there is some, it's both and.
Yeah.
Right? But
it's the intersection of what you're saying because it is fine. I think that it's, some people will have a compulsion, some people won't.
Yeah.
It's what you both are saying, which I believe, is find a purpose bigger than yourself in that business and that money. Or you won't get up the 75th time someone kicks you in the
gut. Because you were compelled. You had, but the same thing that I am, right? You want success.
Yes, that's right.
You want to be successful.
That's right.
You want to be taken seriously in your lane, whatever that is.
Absolutely.
So that's it, right? Yeah. And this person that wrote in this question is compelled by they want to release this product, or I can't even remember which question this was.
And I do think there's a difference between being compelled and purpose.
Define what compelled is.
I think a purpose. So like I look at when you asked that question, the first thing that went through my mind is I would do the businesses I've done, I'd make the choices because I would never want to give back learnings. But maybe I wouldn't do hardware ever again. Maybe I would going back, I wouldn't have done hardware.
In retrospect.
And what went through my brain while I was processing real quick was hardware is hard. They say that because it takes you 18 months to change anything because you are so dependent on other people's errors. When we had Wagget, the best supplier in the world put the wrong product GPS module in 80% of our units, and we couldn't even figure out why. So for 5 months, I had to wake up not knowing what the problem was. Tell me your problem, I'll go solve it. I nearly lost my mind in that process. And then thank gosh we had a community that was a cult and gave us grace, because it took another year and a half to get the product out and millions of dollars because it's so capital intensive to fix that. And even if someone else's fault, you have to wait for the parts, right. You have to do all that, right? So it's like, there's something so hard about it. And I was sitting there going, I don't think I would. But then I was like, do you know what? If I go back in the time machine and wouldn't have done that, I would have lost the opportunity to save animals' lives, period. And there are animals that would not have had the life as long as they could have, as healthy as they could have been. And I wasn't willing to give that up. I think it's a purpose. I think it's
not a compulsion, but a purpose. Yeah.
And nobody could have told you anything when you went into that business. They could have said to you, you're going to have all these issues, and you're going to say, I'm equipped. I can handle this. I can solve those problems as they come down the pike. In retrospect, now you're like, exhausting. But, you know, but nobody could have told you nothing. You stormed through walls.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Speaking of storming through walls.
You're right. Yeah.
And a nutritious, a.nutritious.notebook asked, working on weekends when you are starting a business, how do you balance? Do you? Yes or no?
There's no balance. There's no balance. You just got to listen. There's a friend of mine in law school read a piece about like, how do you stop sleeping? Like, how can you like cut sleep out of your day or whatever? Like, that obviously impossible, but still that's the mentality. I mean, you just have to learn how to get up. You just go dark to dark. And you put stuff around the margins that normally would fit into a person's actual day, and you just put it in the margins. And people have to learn to understand that about you, because you're an entrepreneur and you're starting a business.
Are you okay giving me a personal example?
Yeah. I mean, the year I made partner in my law firm, that's just one example. I mean, I billed 28,056 hours that year. Billed. So that's not all the admin stuff that had to go around it. And that's, I had two kids already and I was divorced. So like, I moved my parents into my house. And I set up, I had two offices in my house, my actual office and my dining room table, because I had two different piles of things that I was accomplishing, you know. And I just was like around, I mean, my kids were there, but they would just be in the other room and they might touch base with me once in a while, but mostly, you know. I mean, when I was at American Apparel, I think I said this in our talk earlier, there was a couch in my office. And for the first several weeks on that job, I slept on that couch, and I would just go downstairs to our store, which was in our big sewing headquarters, and I would just buy new clothes that day to wear, which wasn't super appropriate, but whatever. It was, I mean, it was like leggings and a bodysuit, but like, yeah, but you know, I mean, I just, when you are wrapped up on something, that is the thing you need to be wrapped up on. And yes, there are things, obviously, if your kid is sick or if you have to go to a parent-teacher conference, you've got to figure out a way to fit those things in. But you work 80, 90% of the time throughout your whole life. I mean, that is, you know, if you're not going to succeed in that, what are we doing here? You know?
I have two things to add. I love what you're saying, because what you're saying is what I've heard Jasmine, you say on your podcast, which is before you start something, define the price you're willing to pay for it, because it's going to require sacrifice of something.
Yeah.
And you're sitting here, Chelsea, giving a really great example of what you've shared with your audience in the past, which is define that price up front. And then I will add that I think the balance thing is ridiculous, because if you really peel back, what does balance mean? It means you're 24/7, every second of the minute, working really hard to keep the pressure really equal across everything. And you're working so hard at it. And that is going to give. And it's not what we should be striving for. There's this idea of integration, of defining, as you put it, what price you're willing to pay. And then how do you integrate your life in a way that sometimes you're going to be all in on work. Sometimes you're all going to be all in on kids. Sometimes you're all going to be in on yourself.
Balance is a timeline along your whole life.
Yeah.
Because later on, I was able to pay all kinds. Like during COVID, I moved my daughter and her boyfriend into the house so they could be part of the bubble. And then my ex was there. And then my son was living there. And we had the cat. And we were all just roly-poly around the house. And I just, it was like the most delightful thing in the world. And I was, it's actually why I decided not, until Spark landed on my lap, I decided not, we didn't even go into this, I decided not to take a third CEO gig, because I was like, I want to see my kids through, up and out of high school into college, because that's a really critical period, you know? And so then I had, you know, I was sitting on some boards. I was definitely not working full time, not, you know, on the weekends or anything. I'm not management. I'm, you know, head in, fingers out, you know, that's what they say about board members.
That's beautiful. Board
members, head in, fingers out. And so I captured what I felt was even a more critical period of time in my kids' lives, you know, getting them prepared and into the schools that they desperately wanted to go to, and then getting them packed and then moving them in and reconnecting with my ex-husband, their dad, to do that as a family unit. And I experienced all of that, you know. So all that hard work at the beginning allowed me to completely swing the pendulum, to use your word, and be balanced later on in the timeline, you know.
Totally. Yeah. And as I've said, I don't believe in work-life balance for all the reasons that you guys have talked about.
All.
And it's you have to define balance for your own life and career. And, you know, it changes as time goes on.
So speaking of the swinging of the pendulum, we covered a lot of topics, but just before the camera started rolling, Susan, you reminded, I'm not going to say us, at least not yet, and I'm working toward it, but you said why we do what it is we do. And there was a founder who had sent you a message, and we don't have to get into the message unless you think it's appropriate if we leave people out or leave like any sort of identities. But there was this thing. What is the overall theme of why you do it?
Yeah. So right before we started, I won't give details outside of Sam. Your text me made me say, hey guys, pause. This is why we do what we do, which was you took some advice to that you had to do on the people side. And you had a hard discussion that ended up firing someone, and you know it's better for the whole machine, and you did it. And I am so proud of you and being able to watch you grow and be able to do that hard thing, because I know how big your heart is, but do it for the good of the system. And to know that was incredible to watch. And it was the example of why the four of us do what we do, because we really can see the impact and the hope that we make.
Chelsea, why do you do what you do?
Well, anything I do ever at this point is for the benefit of my family, if you really want to get down to the fundamentals.
That's fine.
I know that's not the answer you were looking for.
No, I wasn't looking
for
an answer.
I'll give you the business reason.
No, I was looking for the truest thing, because I think that what comes up as truth is inspiring and empowering to other people. It is okay. I do what I do for my family.
I do. I really do. I was raised by these incredible parents who did they maximized the hell out of very little. It was like that book, Stone Soup, that we read to our kids where, you know, yeah, I don't have to get into it. Look it up. Stone Soup. Ding. but, you know, and that came from generations of generations of generations of people before them that had taught them how to create a net, whether it's economic or love or whatever it is, for the next generation coming. And it's a small family, but it's a strong family. It's strong DNA that comes from both sides. And so I just feel like it's my obligation, and I love this obligation, to hand that tradition down to my kids and to make them feel like they've got a net, you know? So everything I do at this point, the examples that I set, my core values, the money that I make, you know, the house I provide is for my family.
And if I may, from an outsider's perspective, when you say is to create a net, for people who are listening, you're helping them build their own net too.
And I'm trying to teach them how to fish instead of giving them the fish.
Yes and amen. Jocelyn, why do you do what you do?
It's very simple, just to leave the world better than I found it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, highlight, underscore, bold.
Yes.
I really, people have poured into me, so it is incumbent upon me to do the same. Mm. And I don't have kids, but I have nieces and nephews, and they will inherit a very different world than I inherited and was born into. And so I feel like when we think about generational mentorship or generational sponsorship, we have to be the ones. We have to be the change we want to see. Mm.
Beautiful.
Jasmine, why do you do what you do?
I do what I do to give more than I took. If I can give 51%, to the 49 that I have taken or have been generously given, I will know that I did the thing that I set out to do. So thank you. Thank you for asking. Ladies and gentlemen, watching and listening to the Jasmine Star Show, we've always maintained it's just one piece of action. And so today we're going to up-level it, because we've never had three guests on the show. So we're going to ask for two things. We're going to ask for two things, two pieces of action. Number one, what table can you add a chair to and invite a person to? there is somebody who wants to sit at your table. Even if you think you're sitting at the cafeteria table that all the nerds and like the goths sit at, somebody wants to sit there. Add a chair to that table.
I'm a nerd.
And number two, can you ask somebody for something as uncomfortable as it may make you feel? Those are the two action items, because the women seated at this table have done those things tenfold, and they've set a proof and a framework that they have been told no more than they have been told yes. And they have opened doors for other people who have expressed appreciation and expressed ingratitude, and they continue to do that. So they have proven that they are better on the other side of it. And we all hope that that is the same for you. Thank you. And thank you for watching and listening to the Jasmine Star Show. It is an honor and a privilege.